Coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK,
The Lutheran Inquisitor, examining pressing issues and their ramifications for the church today.
Hello and welcome to the Lutheran Inquisitor. I'm your host, John Ehlers. I'm pastor of Christ Lutheran Church in Orpington, Kent, a southeastern suburb of London. I'd like to invite you along to attend a service. We meet each Sunday at 10:30, or you can check us out on Facebook. Go to facebook.com/ Christ Lutheran Church UK, and you can follow our services there on Facebook. I'm also pastor of the Raynham Mission, and we hope to be meeting again soon the first Sunday of each month at 3 o'clock at the Evangelical Free Church on Woodmore Road. I'd also encourage you to go to our website, lutheran.co.uk, and click on the directory button to find the local Lutheran church to where you live. Go and pay them a visit. I know you'll receive a warm welcome. And we'd like to welcome back to Lutheran Radio Dr. Callum McKellar as we continue our discussion on his new book, Christianity and the New Eugenics, published by IVP. You can find that at Amazon or any other good book distributor. Dr. McKellar is the director of research for the Scottish Council on Human Bioethics. And thank you for joining us, Dr. McKellar.
Thank you very much. It's an honor.
As we continued our discussion this week, we talked about the term eugenics. Can you again refresh our memory? What do you mean by eugenics?
So eugenics can be sort of explained as different strategies and decisions seeking to influence in a positive manner the genetic heritage of a child or a community or society in general. So you're trying to do something to improve genetically these children and society.
And again, you talk about the new eugenics. What makes that new again, very quickly?
So the new eugenics is that the eugenics is coming back. So eugenics was quite popular at the beginning of the 20th century. There were professors of eugenics in London. There were professors of eugenics in Berlin. It was a very respectable ideology. Winston Churchill was a eugenicist. So was Theodore Roosevelt, H.G. Wells. They were all respected members of society, and they were all eugenicists. They all believed that we should do something to try and improve the genetic heritage of the British or the Americans, and that we should try and make sure that all the people who are seen as defective are not able to procreate. So that's the eugenics that took place at the beginning of the 20th century. But this is now all coming back in the last 10 to 15 years. It's not something that society is very much aware of at the moment. It's just happening in academia, in conferences in medical ethics and so on, where more and more people, professors of bioethics, are saying, well, why not? Why should we not continue what started at the first half of the 20th century? Of course, what happened in with National Socialists in Germany was regrettable, but we shouldn't let ourselves be. We should not let that stop us now trying to go back to a new way of improving the society or improving from a biological perspective our children.
Yeah, we're smarter than they are. We won't make their same mistakes.
Exactly. Well, that's the kind of attitude that is problematic, to always believe that we are better than them. We will not make the same mistakes as them because they somehow were inferior. They were different from us, but they weren't. We were all equal, and there's nothing new under the sun. I mean, human beings are just as sinful and confused now as they were then.
So can you give us maybe a few examples of how these procedures are now returning? What is happening in the scientific front?
Yes, there are different procedures actually in eugenics. One of them has been around for quite some time now. So for the last 40 years, at least in the UK, when abortion has been legalized. Now, when abortion was legalized 40 years ago, the Eugenic Society of Britain was very much behind and pushing for the new legislation on abortion. And abortion, in these cases, are for fetuses that are defective from a genetic perspective. So that's been around for 40 years. There's still thousands of abortions taking place every year in the UK because of genetic deformity or genetic disabilities in the embryos or in the fetuses. So that's one way. Another way where eugenics is coming back is, and there's more and more of these cases, a woman wants to have a child, but she hasn't found the right man, so she's all by herself, she's single. And she decides to go to a sperm bank, and sperm banks exist all over the UK and America and so on. Now, when she goes to the sperm bank, she'll have the choice of different kinds of sperm from different kinds of donors. Now, this goes up and down with price, due to, relating to the quality of the sperm, the genetic quality of the sperm. So if the sperm donor is blonde with blue eyes and has a university degree, his sperm will be far more expensive than if the sperm donor was not blonde with blue eyes and never went to university. So again, she'll probably try and choose the sperm with the best genetic characteristics, and pay the price, whatever price that is for that sperm, because she wants the best kind of child. So that again is a eugenic decision. But what is really, probably the reason why we're now talking a lot more about it is that a new procedure that was developed just about 6 or 7 years ago, and actually yesterday the two persons who developed the procedure got the Nobel Prize. So this procedure is called genome editing. So that's changing the genes in the heritage of a child. So they would be able to do this by changing the genes on a sperm cell or an egg cell or a very early embryo, so that the child who is then born has maybe better genes than he would have had. This is where it becomes complicated. I should just say where he would have very good genes that make him better able to compete with other children. So that is what is, those are different areas of eugenics. Another area that you could also think of is even just adoption. So some years ago, when the Berlin Wall collapsed, quite a lot of Westerners were going into orphanages in countries in Eastern Europe, and they were going into these orphanages as if they were going into a supermarket and going through the different bedrooms, looking at the different children and saying, oh, I don't want that one. He's got something wrong with him. And then they go to the next room and they'll see, I don't know, another smiling child who looks perfect and say, well, okay, I'll adopt that child. That's a good quality child, and then adopt that child and bring it back to Western Europe. So that would also be a form of eugenics. And actually this kind of thinking of selecting between children in an orphanage is the kind of thinking that is always present in eugenics. So eugenics is always associated to selection, and that's what makes it ethically problematic, especially from a Christian perspective.
I can't help but just think of animals when you talk about this. I mean, you take the good bull sperm to inseminate the cows. You go to the local pet sanctuary and you pick the best looking cat or dog. It's just in our nature to do that, isn't it?
It is, but it's not like that when we have when we have children. So when until now, at least more or less, well, in most cases, when we have children, we just have whatever child comes to us because we have no choice. The fact that we have no choice also means that we cannot regret the child either. As soon as you have choice, you have the possibility of regretting your choice. Well, when I go to the supermarket, for example, and I go to the tills, there's maybe lots of queues on all the different tills. So I say, well, that queue will go faster. So I go into that queue, and then all the other queues automatically go a lot faster. And I said, oh, why did I not go in that queue instead? So I regret my choice. However, if there was only one till at the supermarket and just one long queue, I would just sit at the back and slowly go forward. I would not regret my choice. And this is really important because children so far have always been unconditionally accepted, unconditionally loved. But as soon as you bring in choice, you also bring in, as I said, this possibility of regret and say, well, why did I have this child and not that child? And that is one of the problems, at least, in eugenics. Choice is not always right, especially if you believe in the unconditional acceptance of a child. And the child also needs to know that he or she is unconditionally accepted by his or her parents. So it goes both ways, and that is extremely important for a healthy relationship, so that a child knows that he's welcomed unconditionally in society, that he's loved unconditionally in society. Otherwise, if the child knows that the only reason why he was brought into existence because his parents wanted him to be good in tennis or good in music, then he can start to say, well, what happens if I'm not very good in tennis or very good in music or very intelligent or very good looking? What happens? Does that mean I no longer have a place in society? Does that mean I'm no longer welcomed unconditionally in society? And these are the kinds of questions that children should never be able to ask, to ask themselves.
And I must confess, I have a real disdain for the quality of life argument that I often hear as well. I suffer from a physical, we used to call it handicap, disability now, I guess. And I just have no time for people who say, oh, we need to get rid of that because those people can't be happy or they can't reach their full potential. And I just want to scream and go, how dare you tell me what I can and can't do and how happy I am or how successful I am. And I think that is such an arrogant argument or an arrogant position to hold. And I, you know, I speak from my position. And again, I think that has to be filtered into the equation as well. And how do scientists or do scientists even think about that?
Exactly. And we all know of friends of ours who maybe have had children who've only lived for 30 minutes. And how can we say that these lives of 30 minutes are any less important, have any less value or worth than the life of Queen Elizabeth or President Obama or whoever? We cannot say because of quality of life or the length of life or the how much pleasure or suffering we've had in life that lives are unequal in value and worth. And that is something that we have to protect in our society because it is the very basis of our civilized society.
Again, I can't help but think of Paul. You know, I pleaded with God to remove the thorn in my flesh, but God said, in your weakness, I am made perfect, manifest. My grace is sufficient to see you through. And I think there has to be a place left for that.
Yes.
Now, again, how can Christians, how can churches learn more about these issues? We talked last week about how these seem to be under the radar. And they are intimidating. They're complex. They're difficult.
Yes.
How can we as pastors, as Christians, really learn more about what's happening in our society?
Well, I think Christians, I mean, the role of the church in my view is always to be a lighthouse, in our society, a lighthouse of love, a lighthouse of truth, a lighthouse of explaining things to society. I think that is one of our duties, one of our roles. So sometimes I get very sad when whole topics never get mentioned in the pulpit. Now, some topics should not be mentioned very often in the pulpit in church by pastors and so on, maybe once a year, maybe once every 2 years, but they should be mentioned. Now, what is happening, I believe, at least in Scotland, is a lot of these topics are never being mentioned in church at all, ever, in any way. It's just ignored completely. So people then say, well, when they're trying to figure out what to do, they go back to the television programs and the soap operas and say, well, he did that in that soap opera, so that must be okay, because that's the only guidance they ever received. I know of some churches in Scotland where some women, and these are faithful women, some women have turned up pregnant, and they are not married. They've not had a boyfriend or anything. And again, as I said right at the beginning, what they just did is went to a sperm bank. But they never knew that going to a sperm bank and just getting yourself inseminated was wrong. Because the Bible doesn't talk about you know, in an 11th commandment, it doesn't say, thou shalt not be inseminated with sperm from a sperm bank. And if the ministers don't preach about it, well, how does the congregation know? So even if Christians don't know, how can even the church be a witness to society? So I believe churches should address these issues, maybe at a special conference, or even, sometimes in Scotland we have evening services where missionaries and so on are invited, and it's a lot more specific than just the morning service. So maybe at evening services this could be done, or Bible studies or so on, but the churches should be talking about this, and the congregations should be guided on it, and the churches should be a light to society on that. So again, it's one of the reasons I wrote the book, to try and sensitize the church to these issues, and to think about them, and to think about them in an informed way.
Can you give us some advice on how we can address these issues in the public forum?
In the public forum, well, so one of the things that my council does, but it used to be done more often as well by some ministers, say in even in Edinburgh. So this is just an example, but in the local press, so this is the newspapers. So in Scotland, for example, we have the Scotsman and the Herald. They are sort of the equivalent of the Guardian or the Washington Times in America. So even just writing articles, or even writing letters, so there's always a letters section in these newspapers, writing letters or even short articles for these newspapers, and giving a Christian input, or even just an ethical input, would help. Now, these newspapers often are, because there's so few people now buying newspapers, are quite low on capital, so they don't have all the journalists they need. So they often now quite welcome people writing in, giving short articles on different topics. Even though they are not selling many newspapers, printed newspapers, that is, their websites reflect all these papers, and of course their websites are free, so that's why they're not getting so much money, because everybody's just going to the website now and not buying the newspapers. But one thing that does also happen is all the politicians, be it in America or in the UK, read the papers, because they want to know how their constituents think about different issues. So that, again, is one way, by writing into the papers and writing letters, that the politicians are influenced. But one of the things we do is organize conferences. So we, this is the Scottish Council on Human Bioethics, we organize a debate between somebody who's, say, in favor of eugenics and somebody who's opposed to eugenics. And that's a very good way of presenting the advantages and the risks, but also getting people to think about these issues. Getting people to think is the key, yeah, I believe, especially in our modern society. Maybe I'm just getting old, I don't know, but sometimes I feel that we've thought a lot more in the past. Maybe we don't, maybe it's just an impression I've got. But getting to people to think is key to try and explain the risks, and there are also advantages of topics like eugenics.
And I think you're right. I think we love the 30-second soundbite anymore. From your perspective, as you look forward over the next 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, where do you see things going? What would you predict the future holds?
So one thing I will predict is that more and more, and this is very sad. I am certain that a lot of Christians will accept the new eugenics. Why? Because they want to have the perfect child, or at least they want to not have a disabled child. So Christians are going to accept more and more eugenics, and that makes me extremely sad, because I think a lot of them who will accept will only think about the kinds of children they want, and not the effects on society all this kind of thinking will have. It also reflects something in them. So if you do choose between a child who is disabled and a child who is not disabled, basically you're saying that the child who is disabled the child who is not disabled is preferable over the child who is disabled, and therefore they're not equal in value and worth in their own lives. And that is a very dangerous way to think, to believe that certain kinds of persons have more value and worth than other kinds of persons just because they're disabled and therefore are preferable. Now, some people might realize that they themselves are not rich enough, do not have enough support by society, or even are psychologically not strong enough to have a disabled child. And that would not be eugenics, because that the problem there would be with them, with the parents, not with the child. But let's say if our parents are rich, they are psychologically robust, and they do have a lot of support from the state, and still decide to only have a healthy child and not a disabled child, then that would be eugenics, because then they would be selecting on the basis of quality of life. And that is a very dangerous way of going. So how can we help this, the churches as well? I think we've got to not just remind the church, but also society, why we are equal. It's fascinating, because I lived in France for a long time, and the motto of France is liberté, égalité, fraternité. So liberty, equality, and fraternity. So if you, it's on all the French coins, even in France. It's everywhere. But if you ask a Frenchman, well, where does this equality come from that is in these three words? Where does this equality come from? Well, I'm sure he would struggle to answer. In a way, this equality comes from a pre-revolutionary France. A pre-revolutionary France, which was Christian, well, at least had some Christian influences in it. And the main influence of Christianity is equality. Before Christianity came, we had slaves, we had racism, we had all sorts of inequalities. And it's actually Christianity that has been such an influence in bringing equality in our society, and also bringing civilization to our society. So if we get rid of equality, which is a very, very strong Christian precept, a very strong Christian, I would say, concept, if we get rid of all that, then we become an uncivilized society. We become a jungle. We become a place where the strong abuse the weak, and so on. So we've got to remind the church, first of all, where this equality comes from, and the church has got to remind society where this equality comes from. And it can be, in a way, it can be a form of evangelism by reminding society what it is really based on. It's based on Christian values.
And I couldn't help but be struck by how you introduced this section by saying they want to select the perfect child. Does that not point to the fact that we as human beings know there's a problem with us? That we are infected by sin, that yes. We are striving to be our own creator, our own master. And right. Again, can we use this to actually demonstrate that actually we are fallen? Whatever we do to tinker with things, it's still not going to get rid of sin, imperfection, frailty, death. We have to still go further than what we can do.
Exactly. And I should say that for some scientists working in these areas, they are quite excited by being able to create new life, becoming like God in a way. In a way, they would be saying that, I mean, when in Genesis, one of the verses says that, and God saw all that he created was good. What these scientists are saying, well, was that they saw all that God created, and lo and behold, it was insufficient. They were sure that they would be able to do better than God. That is the kind of mentality that is coming in. And there's an awful lot of pride there. And it's interesting that one of the most fascinating things in human life is being able to procreate children. I mean, I've talked to all sorts of people, and some of them are quite old and very successful in their lives, as professors of medicine or whatever. And when you ask them, what's the most wonderful thing you've ever done in your life? It's not becoming a great professor or getting the Nobel Prize. It's actually having children. Now, I don't have any children. I'm not even married, so I only study other people's families and other people's children. But that is really something that's really really important for a lot of these older people when they look back on their life. So procreating children is something still magical. It's fascinating. And to be able to control that, there's a lot, but for some scientists at least, there's an awful lot of pride. However, you're right that no matter how perfect, as we see perfection at least, sin will always be there, pride will always be there, we will still die, and we will still be battling against the evil in our society. One thing I should also say is that when we do make differences between disabled and able persons, or with perfect persons and non-perfect persons, we're always seeing this from societal perspective, from a human perspective. But I think the churches, at least, and Christians should, and we should try to do this at least, sometimes it's not difficult, always try to see it from God's perspective. And when God looks at every single person on earth, even right now, they are equal in his eyes. And it's him that matters. It's not even what the church thinks that matters, or what Christians think that matters, or what society thinks that matters. It's what God thinks that matters. And that is extremely important. And when I go into my office every morning, actually, I pray, I say, please God, help me to see things from your perspective, and not from my perspective, or from society's perspective.
Thank you for those wonderful words of encouragement. In the last couple of minutes that we have, could you tell us a little bit about the Scottish Council of Human Bioethics, what you do, and how you contribute to sharing information with Christians and churches on these issues of bioethics?
Yes, so the Scottish Council on Human Bioethics was set up just a few weeks after the first referendum that created the Scottish Parliament in 1997. I mean, I wasn't involved in those days, and it was set up by senior scientists, medical doctors and lawyers to try and be a sort of think tank or a national ethics committee that works with the Scottish Parliament. So from the beginning, the Scottish Parliament has been responsible for biomedical research, transplantation, psychiatry issues, end-of-life issues, euthanasia and assisted suicide, become responsible for abortion just a few years ago. And its responsibility is growing. So what the Scottish Council on Human Bioethics does is looks at what's happening in the Scottish Parliament and tries to inform the Scottish Parliament, so members of the Scottish Parliament, but also journalists and also the churches, societies, but other charities. Right now we're doing research on gender dysphoria, because it's a very complex issue, but we're looking at it from an academic perspective. So all our position statements, we have a website, are informed by academic papers that have been published in peer review journals and so on. So it's all research based. And so we do organize, so we actually always get invited to give oral evidence to the medical committee of the Scottish Parliament when some of the big issues are being discussed. We also organize conferences all right around Scotland. We have a film festival, the only biomedical ethics film festival in the world, actually, every year, where we have 3 days of biomedical ethics themed films, but it could be, science fiction documentaries, and we always have a debate straight after. But as I said, we also work with journalists. So as soon as there's an ethical problem, a biomedical ethics problem in Scotland, actually the journalists just phone us immediately now to try and get a Scottish angle to it for the Scottish media and the Scottish press. But my job personally is to do all the research. So my committee meets every 2 months. And because my committee is made up of senior medical doctors and lawyers and so on who are very busy, I've been employed now for the last 18 years as the director of research. So I prepare all the research and provide that research for my committee so that they can have informed opinions, which are then presented on our website or sent to the parliamentarians in the Scottish Parliament.
Well, we pray God's richest blessings on your work, and thank you for taking the time and giving the effort to publish this new book, Christianity and the New Eugenics. We appreciate it, and we appreciate your time with us and the insights you've given us into eugenics.
Thank you very much. It was a real pleasure. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to the Lutheran Inquisitor with Pastor John Ehlers. If you have any questions or comments about the issues raised in this program, send an email to info@lutheranradio.co.uk. The podcast of this show is available from our website. Check our program online and stay tuned.